Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet distinguished Professor Rich Mayer in this episode. Rich's work explores the relationship of learning to instruction, and his work of over 40 years has resulted in multiple evidence-based principles that apply to the use of multimedia in education, most recently in computer games and virtual reality. Rich and I talked via Skype. I'm speaking today with distinguished Professor Rich Mayer of the University of California. Rich has a specific interest in cognition, and his work has long been focused on multimedia learning, computer-supported learning, and computer games for learning. On a personal level, his book with Ruth Clark, E-Learning and the Science of Instruction, was an early influence in my own career. Rich, it's great to be talking with you.
Thank you. It's wonderful to talk to you also.
Can we start with a brief overview of your career and publications?
So my undergraduate career was at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. I majored in psychology, and then I moved on to the University of Michigan, where I received my PhD, also in psychology. And then I moved on to my first job at Indiana University as a visiting assistant professor. And then I came to University of California at Santa Barbara in 1975. And I've been here ever since in the psychology department, which is now called Psychological and Brain Sciences. My main interest starting in graduate school has always been trying to understand how people learn, and in particular, how we can help them learn so that they can take what they've learned and apply it to new situations. So that's the classic issue of transfer. I think that issue of transfer has been at the heart of both psychology and education from the inception of those fields. So it's a deceptively simple question, but it's one that has a lot of aspects to it that's kept me going through all these years. Some of my initial research focused on looking at effective instructional methods for promoting transfer using things like, advanced organizers, got obsessed with that for a while, or using graphics to help people understand. And that kind of got me more into the area of maybe using multimedia, which I define as using words and pictures to convey information. So I've been spending a lot of probably the last 20 years trying to develop principles for how to design multimedia messages. So instruction involving words and pictures.
Great. You talk about that being deceptively simple, that the concept of transfer of learning. What are some of the more surprising findings that you've had throughout your career?
Well, I think what we all find in this field is that transfer is pretty elusive. It's very difficult to get what I would call general transfer. So having a learning experience that allows you to just get better at everything, I really just have never seen that happen. So I focus more on near transfer, or what I call specific transfer of general methods. So I think you can learn specific content in a way that applies to other contexts, but the transfer is still limited to the actual ideas or methods that you learned about. The idea that transfer is domain specific is kind of one of the themes in cognitive science, and it's certainly a theme in my research. Learning to be good at problem solving and transfer in one domain does not necessarily transfer to other domains.
So there's, I think educators need to be quite creative, don't they? But also evidence informed. And a number of your publications do point towards evidence. Can you just give us an overview of some of the publications that listeners might be recommended to take a look at?
You know, I think we tried to summarize some of the more practical aspects of my research in a book called E-Learning and the Science of Instruction with Ruth Clark. That and I have a more kind of academic version of that in my book called Multimedia Learning. And also in the Cambridge Handbook of Multimedia Learning, which I edited. And what I try to do in this research is to come up with evidence-based principles for how to design multimedia instruction. So for example, one very basic idea, which I call the coherence principle, is that it's better to delete extraneous material from a presentation. So any aspects of graphics or of the text that's not really directly relevant to the instructional objective probably shouldn't be there. So this principle is kind of arguing we don't need graphics with lots of gratuitous color or details that aren't really supporting the main idea, or lots of fancy, cute little details on the screen if it's a computer-based lesson. And we don't need extra, you know, comments in the text. Just want to kind of keep it simple. Just to give you an example, another principle is what I call spatial contiguity. If you're going to have printed words and graphics, it's better for the printed words to be next to the part of the graphic they're talking about rather than separated, let's say, as a caption or in the main body of the text. That way people can more easily make connections between corresponding words and graphics. Another principle is what I call modality principle. If you're going to have graphics and words, it's better for the words to be spoken than printed, because that way people can use their eyes to process the visual material and their ears to process the verbal material. That kind of frees up space in your information processing channels. So let's give you just a few examples of the principles. We have a little bit more than a dozen. I guess one of the more recent ones is what I would call embodiment principle, which is if you're going to have, let's say, an instructor, you know, giving a lesson, it's better for the instructor to actually draw the graphics as he or she is explaining them, rather than having the graphics already drawn and just be referring to them. So the act of watching the instructor do that, making the drawings, helps people learn more deeply. It helps them perform better on a transfer test.
They're absolutely fascinating principles, and of course they're all evidence-based, and they all make quite intuitive sense when you hear them, but quite often they're overlooked, aren't they? I recall another one from the book which talks about if you've got text, that actually verbalizing that text as people read it distracts them. I mean, it's that sort of gem which I think makes a considerable difference to the effectiveness of instruction.
Right, I call that the redundancy principle. It's better not to have both spoken and printed words going on at the same time if you also have graphics. It's just going to overload people's information processing system.
Mm. So, Rich, these findings are well known. They've been public for some time. They've certainly been evident in your publications. And yet still we quite often see them flagrantly ignored, I think, by many practitioners. Well, what do you think the reason for that might be?
I'm a parent. I'm used to being ignored. I'm kind of an optimistic person. I do see some bright spots. I think there's been a lot of interest in multimedia design, and especially among instructional designers. I hear from instructional designers almost on a daily basis. So that makes me feel like people are interested in trying to use evidence-based approaches to what they're doing. And I think, you know, book publishers have expressed interest. A lot of educators have expressed interest. So I do think things will change for the better. The whole field, I think, of educational psychology from the very start, there are quotes from E.L. Thorndike about it's too bad that education doesn't make use of scientific evidence. And if teachers would be more scientific in their approach, they would be more respected. So, I mean, this is a theme that we've had for more than 100 years, and I think it's not going to go away. But I think now educational psychology has a lot to offer. And I would say my work is mainly aimed at what I would call applying the science of learning to education. So I do think this little subfield of the science of learning is growing, and there are a number of folks doing research in this area that has both practical and theoretical implications. And I think it's starting to have an impact and probably will continue to. But I agree with you. There's no shortage of examples of places where we could improve.
Yeah, it's possibly accentuated in online learning, isn't it? When the tools we now have available to us just far outstrip anything we might have had 10, 20 years ago. I mean, it's no problem for an educator to fire up a webcam and actually record a lecture on the screen. Right. And yet that they may lack those access to those principles that you've just talked about.
I think what we're experiencing is a situation where technology is running way ahead of the science. So we have all these wonderful educational technologies that allow us to do these marvelous things. Like you're saying, we can record lectures that are available online. We can develop these stunning graphics. But the science of how you really should do that to be an effective communicator, that's lagging a little bit behind the technological advances.
Mm-hmm. So, Rich, it's now mid-2019, and no doubt, given your perspective, you've seen a lot of online learning in your time. What are some of your observations about online learning and education as it is today?
You know, I don't really see online learning as that different than the more traditional forms of learning. I think we have the same basic issues. You know, how do you design effective educational communications? Because I think what we're talking about is a form of communication. That's the teaching learning, you know, situation is communication between a teacher and a student. And the same principles, I think, that apply to face-to-face instruction, a lot of them apply also to online instruction. I think what I'd be looking for is effective instructional methods. And I think we know a lot of effective methods. I guess a special issue with online instruction has to do with students maybe not feeling part of the learning situation, feeling maybe a little alienated or unmotivated. Mm-hmm. You know, the role of motivation, I think, has a huge impact in learning, and that's a consideration in designing online courses. How do we keep learners active and motivated when it just feels like they're alone looking at a screen?
I'd like to put that question to you, actually. How could we keep learners engaged and motivated if they are just looking at a screen?
Well, you know, I think people will accept a computer as a social partner very easily. And so I think you have to kind of create, believe it or not, I would say rapport between a machine, basically, and the learner. And you can do that by having the instructor talk in a human voice, not a machine voice, talk in a friendly, appealing way, using conversational language rather than formal language, kind of using first and second person constructions rather than just third person. That creates, I think, a feeling of relationship with the online instructor, let's say, who sometimes it's just a on-screen agent that's really a cartoon character. But I think people can feel a relationship with them, and that's what we're going for. We're also right now looking at the emotional tone of the instructor. So we're looking at videos where the instructor kind of exhibits a kind of happy emotional tone versus a more subdued or almost sad emotional tone, trying to look at that as maybe a contributor to students wanting to learn more. And then there are also kind of explicit adjuncts that we can add to a lesson. I collaborated with a colleague on a study where we tried to increase the students' self-efficacy in a online lesson in statistics. So that's kind of a double whammy, because statistics, a lot of students have low self-efficacy for statistics, and if they're going to learn it online, it's even going to be more troublesome. So we added a lot of little adjuncts, like a little online instructor who makes kind of positive, encouraging comments, or who asks for self-affirming statements, asking the learner to kind of type in their feelings about how well they're learning. Just little adjuncts like that did help people learn better. So I think there are ways to encourage involvement. Also, I mean, there are lots of ways to just have the learner be active in terms of interacting with the lesson. Like in simulations or games, these can be done online and still hopefully motivate learners to want to participate.
Yeah. So, Rich, drawing on all of this research and all of these principles, do you think we could really fine-tune our instruction to make it almost perfect?
I do think we could greatly increase the effectiveness of instruction. And I've seen that in the work that we've done. I mean, we've mainly done highly controlled lab studies. So whether those transfer to the real world, you know, is an important issue. In some of our studies, we have gone out in the real world and found positive results. So in those few instances, I'm pleased to see they can be effective. But yeah, I think we can do that.
I'm interested too in your observations about big data. So MOOCs, for example, have been going for a number of years now, and the first studies based on the big data from those MOOCs came out about 4 or 5 years ago. One of the principles I recall was video should be around about 7 to 8 minutes long. Is that consistent with your findings, or is that just suggesting a particular generic type of video? Could we actually extend that time frame if we were to use the right techniques?
You know, it's so interesting. And that's an issue that's been around for more than 100 years. It's really how long should a lesson be? And, you know, how long can somebody really give sustained attention to instruction? I think the consensus 100 years ago was that it's about 10 minutes. And I think that's still the consensus today. Depending on the research you look at, it's somewhere in the 5, 10, 20, 30 minute range. It's hard to do this kind of research, but I do think short, focused lessons make sense for a lot of reasons. We know that distributed practice is better than massed, and so if we can break lessons up into parts, into smaller parts, each one kind of starts over again, I think it's refreshing. It allows us to store the information, start storing the information in a different place. I couldn't definitely say what the ideal length is, but I think it is on that order.
Brilliant. Richard, you've been doing a lot of work on computer games, a lot of experimental work, a lot of clinical work, as you just mentioned. If I was to give you an unlimited research budget to help you take your work further, where would you place it? What's the research you'd most like to see done at the moment?
That's a really great question.
I always love asking that one, yeah.
And I will say, I kind of feel that's been my career. I just feel so fortunate that I've been able to pursue the questions that interest me. Getting involved in games seemed like the next logical step after looking at multimedia instruction, because games are a kind of form of multimedia instruction. Looking to the future, I've gotten interested in virtual reality as a possible venue for promoting learning. I don't really think media cause learning. I think it's instructional methods that cause learning, as our colleague Dick Clark always reminds us. But I do think virtual reality, you know, has affordances that maybe other media can't provide quite as easily. So I've been looking at how to design learning in virtual reality so that it will be effective, and in particular, immersive virtual reality. And we've been also, since virtual reality seems to be emotionally arousing, we've been looking at not only trying to measure learning outcomes, but trying to measure learning processes and affective processes during learning by hooking people up to a portable EEG so we can kind of look at their level of engagement throughout a lesson, and also hooking them up to biometric measures like heart rate and electrodermal activity in the skin, which is an indication of emotional or affective arousal. And what we're finding is, virtual reality is emotionally arousing. You get a higher kind of affective processing when people are in immersive virtual reality. But according to our EEG measures, it also creates more distraction. So it's creating kind of a cognitive processing overload, and it leads to sometimes poor learning. So I think one challenge with virtual reality is that it is so perceptually rich and so stimulating that it might actually be distracting. So we need to design put in design features that are going to keep people focused on the lesson itself so that they reflect on what's going on and not just kind of just have all these fun experiences.
It sounds like really important research. Just to be clear, though, when you talk about having instruction within a VR environment, what do you mean? Is it like attending a lecture in a VR setting, or is it a little bit more immersive than that?
Yeah, it could be more immersive than that. I mean, I'm thinking more of simulations. So, for example, in one lesson, we're using a program called the Body VR, where you take a trip through the bloodstream, and you get to see all the things that are in the bloodstream, and you're learning about the human body, in this case the bloodstream, and you can look around, you can kind of interact in that world. So you put on a head mounted display and you walk around and you're in the bloodstream. in another lesson, you're actually in a World War II battle called Kokoda, which was north of Australia in World War II. That's just to get a feeling for what happened there. And another one, let's see, what else we've been doing. We've been using this program called Labster, which is a simulated science lab. So you can run little science experiments. Has all the instruments you would have in a very sophisticated science lab, so students can kind of learn to do things. So we've been looking at how well students learn in that environment compared to, so that's with a head-mounted display and walking around versus just a desktop version where you're just sitting in front of a screen versus just a PowerPoint presentation. There are lots of interesting possibilities, I think, and more programs are coming online, and the cost of VR equipment, it keeps coming down. So I do think it's something that teachers are going to be tempted to try and use. So I do think we need some basic research on what works and what doesn't work.
Absolutely. And I suppose as haptics become more of a thing as well, it just adds another layer, doesn't it, to the VR?
It does. And we haven't started working with that yet, but that's on the horizon, I guess.
Sounds like very interesting work ahead. So Rich, underneath all of that, it's almost like you're trying to treat the technology as a medium, but your principles sort of underpin effective practice across those media. Am I right in saying that?
That's definitely correct, because we're not really trying to understand the effects of media per se. We're trying to understand the effects of instructional methods. Different media kind of enable the use of certain instructional methods more easily than others. Simulations and games are more interactive. So if we want an interactive instructional method, something computer-based is probably better than something paper-based. But you're absolutely right. I'm interested in principles of instructional design that apply across media, because I think we're working with the same human mind, the same human information processing system. Whether the material is presented on paper or on a screen in virtual reality or in a game, it's people still are processing it through the same information processing system.
And I think to a great extent that makes your work reasonably timeless, doesn't it? Because those principles seem to be quite consistent regardless of what new tools and techniques we have available to us.
I think it's important to build on what's come before. And the science of learning is a field that's, it's 100 years old. We know a lot about learning, and here we're just trying to extend it to, well, what are the implications there for instruction or for education? Instruction and learning are so closely connected that, for me, they're just two sides of the same coin, really. But I do think taking what we know about learning and trying to see how it applies to instruction has been what I've been trying to do, and it's been a lot of fun so far, and I think people in this field are making a lot of good progress.
Absolutely, and I'm sure you have a very grateful public as well for the work that you have published and the work that you have done.
Oh, you're too kind. Thank you.
So, Rich, two people you'd recommend as leaders and legends of online learning, one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you now, and one who you think otherwise might have an important perspective to share.
That's such an interesting question. I mean, there's so many people who have been working in this field have been doing just a fantastic job. And a lot of the more junior people in this field, I think, are coming up with important breakthroughs. But I guess my thinking was influenced, I would say, by John Sweller's cognitive load theory. My cognitive theory of multimedia learning, I think, plays heavily on his idea, especially the idea of limited working memory capacity, which of course isn't John's idea. William James talked about that in 100 years ago. but I think we are recognizing that the implications for instruction are pretty pretty strong when you look at limits on working memory, that is a constraint on instruction. And then let me think who else. I think the idea of generative learning, the idea that learning is a generative process, someone like Merle Whitrock talked a lot about generative learning. And of course, there are folks way back in the history of our field, starting with Bartlett, who really emphasized the role of generative processes in learning. I think it's an idea that has always been there, but it's really comes to light when we try to look at computer-based learning and to try to recognize that it's a generative process.
Absolutely. Well, Richard, it's been wonderful talking with you. Thank you so much for linking us back into the history of classic ideas there, and also for your ongoing work. It's certainly, as I mentioned earlier, influenced me, and I trust it's influencing others around the world too, and in quite profound ways. Thank you for being a leader and legend of online learning.
Thank you so much for talking with me, Mark. I appreciate it.
You can learn much more about Rich and his work and find links to the various publications he mentioned from our website.
That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.